Welcome from Douglas Cameron to this special celebration of independent radio journalism on Britain's first commercial station, LBC. Over the next 3 hours and 20 minutes, we'll be taking you on a magnificent and moving journey through the history of the last 20 years. LBC was launched in 1973 next door to Dr. Johnson's house in Gough Square, a stone's throw from Fleet Street. Morning presenter David Jessel was the first voice to be heard, and the first story was the Yom Kippur War between Israel and several neighbouring Arab countries.
This is London Broadcasting, the news and information voice of Independent Radio. Welcome to LBC. It's 6 o'clock, October the 8th. My name's David Jessel, this is The Morning Show, and here's the news.
This is Ken Guy with LBC News. The Middle East War. A meeting of the United Nations Security Council has been called in a bid to stop the fighting. It'll be held at 8:30 tonight, British time. The meeting was called after an urgent request from the United States early this morning. President Nixon has returned unexpectedly to Washington, cutting short his stay in Florida to take personal control of the American attempt to stop the war. Diplomatic sources say the Americans fear that more Arab states will join in the war if it is allowed to continue. Meanwhile, on the two main fronts at Suez and the Golan Heights, fighting still rages. Israel claims that several hundred Arab tanks are trapped in Sinai and that they have destroyed the Egyptian bridges across the canal. But they admit that Syria has gained a foothold in the Golan Heights and has advanced several kilometres.
Throughout LBC's 20 years, we have brought moving and evocative reports on national and international events from all parts of the globe as they happened. This was illustrated in our first hour of broadcasting, as Israeli forces continued towards the battlefront. Richard Gross sent this report from the Golan Heights as the tanks rolled by.
Here comes another one, I think. No. Now, this one has the gun facing forward. Two men staring out of the top turret. It's Main Street, actually, in more normal times. It's like a main street anywhere. Traffic here is tanks, armored half-tracks, command vehicles, and jeeps. The stuff of an army on the move. That's because this town is hard by the frontier with the occupied Golan Heights. Here comes another tank. Tank commander gave a wave. The troops and vehicles have been moving through this town on the way to the front since Israel first started mobilizing its troops on the first day of the war. If I turn around, I can see puffs of white smoke on the hills on this side of the heights that face Israel proper, and they're from dulled explosions that one can hear from time to time. The soldiers here have been mobilized hastily, and some of them are still wearing dungarees or civilian shirts or t-shirts, and they're either going to change into uniform on the way to the front or else go fight in their dungarees. Traffic here is heavy, the heaviest it has been since the last war in 1967. One soldier told me this time it's going to be the last one. This is Richard C. Gross at a small town in northern Israel near the occupied Golan Heights of Syria.
LBC's inauguration was marked with the release of 1,000 carrier pigeons and a series of birthday messages from the leading politicians of the day, Prime Minister Edward Heath, Labour leader Harold Wilson, and Liberal leader Jeremy Thorpe. Here's David Jessel again.
As you may have noticed, we're on the air, and we'd like to thank all of you who've written in to us to wish us luck. People like Mr. Wallace Crevett of Reigate, and the Prime Minister, Mr. Edward Heath, from Number 10.
The opening today of the London Broadcasting Company's station marks a new departure in British broadcasting. It's the first station of the Independent Broadcasting Authority's local radio service, and the first all-news radio station in this country. I'm sure its 24-hour service of news, information and comment is going to be of immediate value to Londoners, and eventually it will be of use to listeners to other stations throughout the United Kingdom, who are going to receive a news service from this station. I'd like to wish the station, its staff and the IBA's local radio service every success.
And our thanks to the Prime Minister for finding time to record that birthday card. And equal thanks to the Leader of the Opposition, Mr. Harold Wilson, for his birthday message to LBC.
It is well known that the Labour Party have opposed the introduction of commercial broadcasting. But that in no way prevents me from offering my best wishes to the Independent Broadcasting News Service. Independent television news has rightly earned a reputation for its thoroughness, for its impartiality, and for the great service it gives to the nation. I have every confidence that the same will prove to be true from the outset with the Independent News Service, which is now to be provided for radio. I'm particularly confident in that prediction because of the wise choice of an editor who I know will regard this as a job requiring dedication and whose past record in journalism has shown his high degree of integrity, impartiality, and a desire to serve the public.
Mr. Harold Wilson and Mr. Jeremy Thorpe, the Liberal Party leader, has been good enough to send us a card.
May I send my best wishes to London Broadcasting as you start transmissions. Every additional outlet for news, current affairs and information is another window on the world. As one who believes in genuine competition, your advent to the world of broadcasting is a very healthy development. And I hope that your station and its staff will have a long, happy and successful career to the benefit of all your listeners.
1973 saw the wedding of Princess Anne and Captain Mark Phillips at Westminster Abbey. Nobody could have imagined then, nor later, that all the marriages of the Queen's children would end in separation or divorce, and with Anne remarrying. The line of questioning adopted by journalists in this pooled interview in November 1973 would nowadays be regarded as rather sexist.
Do you think you'll make a good housewife? I mean, can you cook, for example?
Well, that's hardly up to me to say either.
Cook scrambled eggs. I don't recommend this.
Yes, I mean, I've done a bit of cooking my time.
Would you like to cook Captain Phillips' breakfast before he goes off to work, for example?
I can manage that. It's easy. Especially when he's venting, because he's not going to get more than a cup of coffee.
Can you sew? Can you put a sew on a button?
Yes, I'm not totally useless. I was quite well educated, one way or another.
Would you expect a sew on his button?
It depends how often they come off, I think.
Mm. Yeah, she has done. It's still there, too.
When the wedding is over, would you expect much more privacy?
I think one hopes, doesn't one?
I think one hopes that one's private life, one's life at home will be private, I think.
Would you expect to be rather more an officer's wife and rather less a princess?
I think at Santos this is a difficult one. From my point of view, it's not quite such an easy role to see oneself in as an instructor's wife, whereas if one was with the regiment, that's a much more clearly defined role, I think. Yeah, I just have to see how it goes.
There's been a lot of talk about being an officer's wife and things. I think people tend to forget that in fact, you know, after we're married, that Princess Anne was still doing an awful lot of work. She spends hours and hours and days working, and day after day, and there are only a limited number of hours in the day and a limited amount of what you can do in a day.
I mean, possibly people don't really appreciate, you know, if you do a day in the provinces or a full day like that, which one may do two a week or something, just how much time is required both in the office and on the ground before you actually get there and the time spent there. I think, you know, one's not going to be sitting at home with nothing to do, put it that way. I mean, one's not going to say, right now I'm going to be in office as well because I've got nothing better to do. I think, you know, one's got to try and fit it in.
Captain Phillips, Princess Anne, in protocol, must always precede you. Do you find that offends your male ego?
No, I mean, I think... No, not at all. I think the I think probably where most of one's life is in the home, and I think in the home I keep my end up. So I'd like to think I keep my end up one of them.
I mean, one knows how difficult it is actually, because and he says he's got problems, but you know, on tours when I used to go with the parents on my own, the sort of Ten and Charlie, it's much the same feeling, because you're there and you know you're being watched and people are interested in you, but the person that people came to see and the point of the exercise is either one's parents or one's elder brother, which puts you in a very difficult position, you know, and it's not an easy one, I don't think. I mean, I you know, I've never felt it was very easy, and I think I know how he's going to feel.
But as far as the home is concerned, you're your boss.
Yes.
1973 and 74 saw the IRA launch its terrorist campaign in mainland Britain. There was a series of horrific car and pub bombings in London, Guildford and Birmingham. Reporter Ed Boyle arrived on the scene shortly after one of the pub bombings.
The quaint shopping streets littered with broken glass, footprints in blood outside a clothing store, people crying, policemen everywhere. Guildford has never seen and never wants to see again anything like it. Outside what's left of the Horse and Groom pub, a woman in her housecoat described what happened.
I just heard the banging and I just rushed to the window, and then I just saw three people running up the road, three men running up the road, and just the crowd running out and screaming and shouting and glass. Just I got to the window, so we saw the four blasts of the glass coming out. It really frightened me to death. I was shaking like a leaf, and the screaming and the shouting going up there was terrible. One of the girls that came out, she was screaming and shouting, and she said that they were in the midst of a party, but oh, I never want to see anything like that again. Mm. It was really awful.
Did you see any of the injured yourself?
Well, I did, because I, you know, I walked out there, and when I saw the blood, that was enough for me. Oh, it was, and then I saw the two lying on the pavement, dead over there on stretchers. Oh, it was frightening.
Down the street, three girls screamed hysterically. A young man, an off-duty soldier, tried to comfort them.
Well, I don't know, we just sort of went to see what was happening, you know, and these two girls just broke down, you know, that's as much as I can tell you. Apparently nobody knows anything what's happened as yet, you know, that's as much as I can say.
You know, were you in the pub at all?
No, I wasn't, I've just got down to me, so, you know, we would have been in normally, but we weren't tonight, you know, I've got nothing else to say, you know, I'm sorry.
There were significant developments in broadcasting in the 1970s. The House of Commons decided to allow the nation to tune into debates and parliamentary question time. Here's a recording of the experiment in 1975 with Ed Boyle, by now LBC's political editor, trying to make sense of the proceedings.
Monday, June the 9th, 1975, a date for the history books.
Order!
And Mr.
Order.
Speaker...
Mr. Patty!
Calling Mr. Patty the first question.
Mr. Speaker, we intend to do our utmost to see that the Shipbuilding and Aircraft Industries Bill is made law in the present session. As I explained to the House on the 17th of March, it would not be appropriate to estimate the costs at this stage because of the large number of unquoted securities to be acquired.
Mr. Patty,
The Secretary of State not agree that although he has, as usual, neglected to answer the question as far as the cost is concerned.
In 1975, the IRA continued its terror campaign with assassinations and bomb attacks, but four IRA gunmen were cornered in a flat in Marylebone, where they held a family hostage. It became known as the Siege of Balcombe Street. LBC reporter John Snow followed the events for 6 days and, using one of the first portable telephones, enabled LBC to be the only station in the world to cover the end of the siege live.
Four
gunmen have come out. The siege here has just ended 1 minute ago. There is still a great deal of activity here, but a flashing blue lighted van has just swept off into the distance with its siren wailing. Briefly, a figure came out onto the balcony, looked over, went back in again. Another came out, looked over, went back in again. And then suddenly we saw the four being led across the street into the van, into the police van, and away they've been swept. There is still very heavy armed cover here all round. I'm just getting further information. Just one moment. A gunman with a white handkerchief has literally just come. Really, it is so dark up that end now. We obviously are going to have to wait for the firm confirmation of the police, but the evidence so far is that we are right at the very end of this siege.
In 1975, Margaret Thatcher became the first woman leader of a British political party. She defeated William Whitelaw, Geoffrey Howe and two other male MPs to head the Conservative Party after it had lost two general elections. Here's what she had to say in the middle of the leadership campaign.
I think the answer to that is that if you change leaders, there's obviously going to be a completely different style of government. Let me put it this way. The present Prime Minister, Mr. Wilson, is a very different kind of leader of the Labour Party than old Clem Attlee was. Both of them had their own individual characteristics and style and emphasis, but both were fundamental believers in their own party philosophy. Mr. Heath and I are fundamental believers in a Conservative Party philosophy, and indeed this is what belonging to a party means. But obviously his style is very different from what mine would be. I have a family background, a very different experience from the experience which he has had.
Are there any particular actions over the past few years which you think has marked a departure from what your policy should have been?
Well, I think undoubtedly people have felt a little bit unhappy about some of the things which we did between 1970 and 74 and felt that it departed a little bit too far from Conservative philosophy, or appeared to. Now, I must take some share of the responsibility for that because I was a member of that cabinet. But I think now we ought to look back and assess what went wrong, because after all, we lost two elections in succession. And say that now we must look ahead and keep our policies well in tune with our own beliefs. Because, you see, I think those beliefs, the true Conservative beliefs, really strike a chord in the hearts of everyone.
We're talking of striking a chord in the hearts of everyone, and having just toured your own constituency, I'm sure you struck a chord in the hearts of your own constituents. I wonder whether you think you'd strike a chord in the hearts of, say, the men of Bolsover. Do you think that perhaps north of the Wash that you'd go down quite as well as you do in the south of England?
But I was born in the Midlands.
I'm sorry, you've always had, I didn't know that, but you've always had the image of a lady of the south.
Well, I was born and brought up for the most telling years of my life in Grantham, Lincolnshire. So when you say the Wash, it does indeed touch memories in my own life. All my ideas about life, about individual responsibility, about looking after your neighbour, about patriotism, about self-discipline, about law and order, were all formed right in a small town in the Midlands. And I've always been very thankful that I was brought up in a smaller community, so that you really felt what a community could be.
Have you felt there's been any attempt on the part of your opponents, probably on the other side of the house, to tar you with the brush of being a lady of suburbia, the lady who stores food in her larder?
Goodness me, I learned to have a jolly good store cupboard, again, by virtue of being the daughter of a very prudent housewife. And we did then. And we used to use some bottle things when they were cheap and put them in your store cupboard, and you could, in that fact, that way see yourself through the winter frequently with your bottled fruit.
So no stepping back from what you advised then?
Indeed, no, it was very sound, and the longer we go on with rising prices, the more sound it is. It's always good, sound housewifery and good, sound budgetary policy to be economical.
And finally, can I just ask you, any fears of the divisions that might be caused in the Tory party by the kind of campaign that's going on in the corridors at the moment, and indeed what seems set to continue if we have a second and third ballot?
Oh, look, I hope it'll soon all be over now. It's not very particularly pleasant for any of us. Inevitably, if you're having a contest, you put forward your own view. But my attitude is that the moment it is over, the moment a decision has been taken, whoever is leader, we all unite and go ahead together.
1975 also saw the end of the Vietnam War. Saigon fell to the North Vietnamese Army. There were scenes of panic at the U.S. Embassy after all the Americans left in a mass evacuation. Desperate attempts were made to get onto the shuttle service of helicopters lifting people from the roof to U.S. warships in the South China Sea. LBC reporter Julian Mannion stayed behind to greet the conquering army.
Was just a few hundred yards away in Saigon's main street. Having turned round, I was driving a Jeep at that time, after seeing the first Viet Cong tank with this enormous flag waving over the top of it. And in fact, at the moment that I saw one of the very first armoured vehicles to enter the city, and at that moment there was still some firing going on. I'm not quite sure why still. Certainly we got what sounded like a round of some kind going straight over the top of our Jeep. And at that moment, I turned the thing round and headed back into towards the centre of town. And I was just driving back the other way and had just left, got out of the Jeep, when suddenly from the other direction, that's from the river, these first tanks had come up from the Bien Hoa, the northern side of town. Then suddenly from the river end of town came more Viet Cong units, this time in Jeeps and trucks with enormous flags waving over the top of them again. And the first Jeep, which went to the National Assembly building, which is where I was by this time, an important building in the center of town, which was one of the first that they got to, the first Jeep was full of Viet Cong, South Vietnamese guerrilla soldiers, dressed in a very peculiar assortment of uniforms, carrying a lot of American captured weapons, and at the head of them, an extraordinarily beautiful South Vietnamese girl, a Viet Cong girl soldier, standing in the Jeep, waving to the people who had assembled in absolute astonishment around this building. That obviously, I mean, it was a propaganda thing, I personally believe. They'd put her there on purpose, and in fact they masterminded the whole thing in a very well-disciplined, very well-organized way. This Jeep swept up to the National Assembly building. The soldiers, including this girl, jumped out waving their weapons and shouting, we're liberating Saigon. And with the first flag, a couple of them, with photographers, they had photographers with them, the first few soldiers rushed up to the steps of the National Assembly, dragged down the South Vietnamese flag, and hoisted in its place this massive Viet Cong banner. Whatever one's political views about the rights or wrongs of the war, what is indisputed is that the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong soldiers were far better disciplined, far better controlled, and just basically obeyed orders. And it was clear from the very first few minutes that they had orders not to molest foreigners in any way, at least in that initial stage. And though some of them were clearly astonished to see us in this city which they had taken, and having heard on their own radio that all the Americans had left, they looked at us in blank amazement. That was some of them. Others of them stood in their jeeps and trucks and waved to us with almost hysterically happy. And we waved back in that peculiar mixture of relief and tension that came with knowing, of course, that they were not going to shoot at us, that basically by that stage everything was going all right. We certainly never experienced much direct hostility, and I would certainly say that from the time of the liberation itself, if one can call it that, we never felt our lives to be in any direct danger. Certainly they were a lot more pleased to see us on the first day, when they were obviously, as I say, very happy, almost delirious with joy, some of them, than afterwards, because afterwards this strange quizzical note came into their faces whenever they looked at us. They really couldn't quite understand. This was the ordinary soldiers. They couldn't quite understand why we were there in many cases. But they still all smiled, many of them, and the ones that didn't smile behaved in a very, very restrained fashion. As I say, they basically obeyed orders, and they had orders not to molest us. Now, the things occasionally got a little bit difficult. If you tried to go somewhere where you weren't supposed to go, the soldiers would stop you with this very, very firm, disciplined manner that is, it was in complete contrast to the way the South Vietnamese army used to control things, which was generally rather hysterical and rather uncontrolled. The North Vietnamese soldiers, on the other hand, when they didn't want you to go anywhere or they wanted to move you away, they always did the same thing. They came towards you without talking and made this gesture with their hands, this very restrained but nevertheless powerful gesture with their hands, with their hands wide open, just to say, go away, in a very forceful way. And there was no arguing with this. If you attempted, if you stayed there, or if you even attempted to argue the point over it, the gesture would just be repeated that little bit more firmly, with a bit of menace behind it. No serious menace, but just that enough to make you feel there was no arguing the issue at all.
Looking back over the last 20 years, it's incredible to reflect on the march of technology. In 1976, the LBC newsroom was equipped with typewriters, not the sophisticated computer systems we have now. Reporter Chris Hamousios observed Concorde's first commercial flight, and Labour's Peter Short talked about its importance to international travel.
She's gathering speed... There she goes, right in front of me now. Tremendous speed. The Air France one is moving. There she goes, right. Tremendous roar of a Rolls-Royce engine. Fantastic roar, and she's heaving herself off the ground. Up, up she goes. Away she flies. The great eagle soaring into the sky. A beautiful white delta. Set against the grey background of the clouds. Brown
British
smoke
Gulf Alpha
pouring out of her engines. Fantastic speed. She soars away.
This evening, when we arrive in Bahrain, and when the French Concorde arrives in Rio, the world will be only half the size that it is this morning. I'm confident that this is just the beginning, that it will not be long before we shall see regular services across the Atlantic to both North and South America. And when that happens, travelers will demand such a service on other routes around the globe.
In 1977, Her Majesty the Queen Elizabeth II celebrated her Silver Jubilee. She went on a nationwide tour to meet her people, and LBC's microphones followed her. We hear Chris Hamousios giving us a sound picture of Windsor Castle with the lighting of the first Jubilee bonfire, the beginning of a network of bonfires being lit throughout the Commonwealth. We also hear reporter Rick Davis with an armada of boats on the River Thames.
In the olden days, Jubilees were celebrated at the golden 50th year. The horns were sounded, and a period of rest, mercy, and pardon was proclaimed. There was a distinct sabbatical flavour about the proceedings. It is beginning to dawn on me that a silver jubilee is of a somewhat different nature.
And the Queen now bends down and she lights the fuse with the silver Olympic torch. The fuse, it's burning pink, and the suspense is quite something. It's, the Queen is standing there, not quite sure what to do with the silver torch. We're all hoping that the fuse will catch, and it's caught. Goodness me, the sparks are really flying. The Queen was perilously near then. Smoke billowing out. The fuse is leaping, sparking, spitting away. And the bonfire, in fact, someone has already lit the bonfire from the other side, I think. As the Queen now hands the silver torch to a Boy Scout, and off he runs with it. In fact, it is now starting its journey to Australia. That was an Australian scout. So off he goes, and it's going to make its way all the way around the world. The smoke now is really pouring out of this bonfire. As I say, 35 feet high. Oh, the smoke is quite incredible. And flames billowing, more sparks. It's really got going now, after only about a minute. As the Queen, Duke of Edinburgh, smiling away. Prince Andrew, Princess Anne... And it's really well lit now. The flames leaping into the sky and clouds of thick grey smoke being swept towards the castle itself by quite a nippy breeze.
A
And as the Royal Trumpeters strike up a fanfare, the fireworks have started, the lights have gone out, and there are the rockets, all sorts of colours, pink, blue, in the distance at the bottom of Snow Hill, where I'm now standing with the royal party behind me. Beautiful sight, pink, blue and white and yellow as they light up the sky. And in fact, there's Windsor and twinkling in the distance, and although it's dark, there's, I can just see Windsor Castle floodlit in the distance. Superb rockets shimmering away, bursting in the sky. There is the map of Britain made out of light bulbs, which are lit up, quite a few of them already. There's the big fat one in the middle, Windsor, and then radiating, each beacon is lit within 3 minutes interval of the other. So there's one in Hog's Back, and then Dunstable Down, Thurfield, Ely, and Sandringham. Apparently they had to cheat a little bit with Ely, and a man had to climb up the cathedral. And there is the superb set piece we were promised. It was a surprise. It's a huge thing on a wooden trellis, and it is the Jubilee motif, the laurel wreath enclosing the crown above the figures 1977, and below it the Queen's silver Jubilee, all lit up, laurel in green, the figures 1977 in red, the Queen's silver Jubilee in white, and the crown in yellow. Clouds of smoke billowing up, and just listen to those rockets going off.
Of Tower Hamlets and her royal entourage. Thousands of people here, mostly local, but I've also heard more than just a smattering of foreign voices. And as the St. Catherine's Pier is so close to the Tower of London, that's not really very surprising. You can hear a great cacophony of horns, hooters and blowers of almost every description going up from the 300 yachts and outboards and assorted small crafts. The Queen is now almost halfway through her royal progress up the Thames. She's already been to Greenwich and to Deptford Steps and to Southwark this morning. At all her stops, the Mayor and Mayoress of the local council have accompanied her. And right now, the Mayor of Tower Hamlets is beside her in a dark suit with his well-polished chain of office gleaming around his neck. The Queen stopping and saying hello to huge numbers of people who've been pressing against the ropes to get a better view. She hasn't been able to resist stopping and talking. Probably why she's about 20 minutes late. As soon as she leaves here, the Queen will have lunch on board the Royal Yacht Britannia, which is now anchored by the Tower of London, and she'll be inviting a party of guests to come on board with her. And later on, the Queen will continue up the Thames, stopping at Lambeth Pier. Listen to that noise. I don't think the Queen has received a noisier reception anywhere throughout the Jubilee celebrations.
In 1978, two popes died, and by the end of the year, a cardinal from Krakow in Poland was chosen to lead the Church of Rome. He came from a communist country, and there were already the beginnings of a major dissident movement, which was to blossom into solidarity a few years later. Peter Gould travelled to the Vatican to report on this remarkable story of three popes in just 1 year.
No one could have guessed back at the start of the year that 1978 was to be the year of three popes. The death of Pope Paul VI in August was a big enough shock for the Church, after his 15 years as spiritual leader of the world's 700 million Catholics. I was present in St. Peter's Square on a warm summer's evening for his funeral. The Cyprus coffin, now being slowly carried into the basilica, will be placed within the lead and oak caskets which make up the traditional triple-lined papal coffin. It will then be lowered into the ground and covered with a simple marble slab. And no sooner had the simple open-air service ended, the guessing game began over the choice of his successor. The cardinals were locked in their conclave, and the crowds gathered in St. Peter's Square to await their decision. They didn't have to wait very long. At the end of the first day's voting, white smoke rose from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel. And then, the announcement to the huge crowd.
Annuncio Vox Gaudium Magnum.
I announce to you a great joy. We have a pope. The cardinal's choice was Albino Luciani, the Patriarch of Venice, who took the name John Paul I. He was such an outsider for the job that even he seemed shaken by his election. But his humble manner and his winning smile captured hearts around the world. And so it was with stunned disbelief, 33 days later, that the world woke up to the announcement that he died suddenly of a heart attack. Once more, the church was plunged into mourning. Another funeral, then another election. This time, the crowds in St. Peter's Square had to wait longer, 2 days, before the black smoke rising from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel changed colour.
And that's the signal everybody's been waiting for, white smoke rising from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel. It means the world's 700 million Catholics have a new pope. And you can hear what the thousands of people here in St. Peter's Square think about it. As soon as they saw that smoke, they burst into applause and began cheering. Even more people are now rushing into the square from all sides. The only question that remains to be answered is who the cardinals have chosen.
But there was a shock for the huge crowd of Italians gathered in the square. Their new pope was Cardinal Wojtyla from Poland, the first non-Italian pope for over 400 years. But the new Pope John Paul II soon won over the critics with his warm and informal manner and his command of several languages. This was his first message in English, given during an audience for newsmen.
I would like to offer my greetings and my blessing not only to you, but to all your colleagues throughout the world. I would ask to be remembered to your families and to your fellow citizens in your respective countries. Please accept, all of you, my expression of respect, esteem, and fraternal love.
In 1979, Mrs. Thatcher continued to make history by becoming Britain's first woman Prime Minister. She defeated James Callaghan in a general election which followed the winter of discontent when public service sector unions went on strike for more pay. Rubbish piled up on street corners. A victorious Mrs. Thatcher decided to quote St. Francis of Assisi when the election results guaranteed her tenancy of 10 Downing Street.
Her Majesty, the Queen, has asked me to form a new administration, and I have accepted. It is, of course, the greatest honour that can come to any citizen in a democracy. I know full well the responsibilities that await me as I enter the door of number 10, and I'll strive unceasingly to try to fulfil the trust and confidence that the British people have placed in me and the things in which I believe. And I would just like to remember some words of St. Francis of Assisi, which I think are really just particularly apt at the moment. Where there is discord, may we bring harmony. Where there is error, may we bring truth. Where there is doubt, may we bring faith. And where there is despair, may we bring hope.
In 1980, the Iranian embassy in Kensington was taken over by gunmen demanding the release of political prisoners. London suffered another dramatic siege under the eyes of the world's media. After 6 days, the gunmen began to shoot their hostages. The first to die was the Iranian press attaché, whose body was unceremoniously dumped onto the steps outside. They threatened to murder a hostage every 30 minutes. LBC reporters Malcolm Brabant and Peter Dealey presented this extraordinary live broadcast when the SAS went in with black uniforms, balaclavas and submachine guns. We also hear the voices of Metropolitan Assistant Commissioner Peter Nevins and Commissioner Sir David McNee.
Quick! Come to me! There have just been three explosions which have ripped through the embassy building. Smoke is wafting over the roofs now, and there are gunmen and there are policemen on the balcony on the just over the doorway. They appear to be going in. That came just a short while. And there's gunfire going. I just heard one shot. And I can hear dogs barking. I'm looking through binoculars at the moment, and that was completely unexpected. Stay with me. This came just about, and there's another shot being fired. It's impossible to see just what is going on because there is a police barricade in front of us and lots of vans and everything. Excuse me a minute. But this came just half. This comes just half an hour after the first body was wheeled out of the building. It's not known exactly what is going on inside, but it's assumed that there was a deadline set, the demands weren't met, and somebody was shot. The body was brought out just before 7 o'clock. Now all around me there is expectation. There are policemen crouching down behind vans. There are dogs being kept to the ready, and policemen wearing flak jackets are crouching down. And everybody down, there's an order gone, everybody down. This is a completely unexpected turn to the siege, which, as I said earlier, well, there is another explosion and a waft of black smoke going up behind the embassy. It appears that the gunmen seem to be carrying out their original threat to blow up the embassy and possibly kill the hostages if their demands weren't met. Those demands, you may remember, were for 91 prisoners from Arabistan jails to be freed from Iran and for a plane to free them. Obviously, the moves which the police had hoped would work haven't. But at the moment, there is all pandemonium let loose here at the embassy. Quiet, and there's the sound of smashing glass coming from around the embassy area. It's impossible to see exactly what is going on because of the barricades in front of me. If you'll just pause so I can listen to what is going on, stay with me. Another shot being fired. And those flames are coming out of the first floor of the Iranian embassy now. It looks as though the gunmen, it's not known just how many gunmen there are, but it looks as though they're sticking to their threat to destroy the embassy. Smoke is rising now above. The flames are getting thicker and more, raging more as the smoke rises up above the embassy. And there's a white flag being raised from the second window. A white flag being waved out of the window. Presumably that's by the gunman. Could this be that the siege is all over?
Fire on the second floor is spreading. It looks as though it's spreading now to the third floor. The building, which is totally blacked out by the smoke and the flames, is engulfed in this terrible drama that we're now seeing. And the police are positioned to wait for people to come out. The guns are now out. They're behind every vehicle, every obstacle they can see. There seems to be a general order to surround the building, and it looks as though, I think that's two more shots we're hearing, so it's still live at the moment.
Yeah, back to me, Peter, and I can hear shots being fired now. They sound like small arms or rifles. So presumably the battle for the Iranian embassy is still going on, despite the fact that a white flag was held out of a second floor window about 10 minutes ago. It would appear that perhaps the gunmen haven't yet surrendered. Down Kensington Gore, just behind the wall which separates Princes Gate from the road way back to Hyde Park, I can see fire engines, ambulances, all with the lights on, all with their blue lights flashing, and ambulances coming up to the embassy ready to take away people. The firemen and all the paramedical people are crouching behind the walls, and a man is running in with a stretcher now. Two policemen are running in with stretchers down beside the side of the building. More are going in now.
built policemen from Exhibition Road, which is adjacent to Princes Gate, are now running, wearing helmets. Maybe this means that this gunfighting is at an end and that the mopping up operation is going on. There are policemen running alongside the walls by the embassy, and they're being covered by other men with guns, policemen with machine guns, policemen with pump-action shotguns. And their task now is presumably to get the casualties out. But the fact that there are stretchers there does mean that there are casualties. And looking down the road towards Kensington, looking down Exhibition Road towards Kensington, the smoke has completely blocked off the road. The smoke from the fire, which is now coming out of the first floor of the building, the flames are leaping about 10 feet out of the window, and the smoke is going up about 200 feet into the air. As Peter said, who would have imagined that this siege would have ended this way?
The siege has come to an end, and I'm unable to give you any details at the moment, but I've been asked to say to you that at the request of the police and with the approval of the Home Secretary, units of the SAS regiment were deployed in the final stage of the operation. Any further questions on the deployment of the SAS, we should direct them to the Ministry of Defence.
Have you any idea how many people have died? If there are any casualties?
Are there any casualties at all?
Yes, I gave you details of one casualty earlier on.
Yes.
I'm not in a position to tell you any more details. I'll give you further details at the yard when we make a detailed statement.
Which
but there will be no conference this evening. We've got a big assessment to do here, and we'll give you just the bare details in a statement issued by the Commissioner at a later stage, somewhere in the region of about 9:30 at the present rate of progress.
Are any gunmen
it would
in
seem
custody, sir?
That it's how still not clear exactly how many people have died.
I'm not at liberty to say.
Are there survivors?
Yes.
Mr. Nevins.
There are survivors, Mr. Nevins just said.
I'm giving you all the details of the hostages in deference to the relatives.
He says he can't give us all the details of the hostages because of the feelings of the relatives. We're just trying to find out whether there's a policeman injured. We're just asking a policeman to see whether...
That is incorrect, thank you.
Mr. Nevins, you are obviously pleased at what has happened. It's been a good conclusion to this siege.
Anything that costs anybody's life, I don't regard as a good conclusion. We would have liked a peaceful resolution to this whole affair. Unfortunately, they took this extreme action that you saw, and the Commissioner had no option but to consult rapidly with the Home Secretary and deploy the SAS.
It is a matter of deep regret that the siege had to be ended by violence. Peace waited and negotiated patiently over 6 days and tried every possible means except of giving in to terrorism.
1980 also saw the controversial Moscow Olympics. The United States called for a boycott of the Games because of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. 62 countries stayed away. But many Olympic committees decided to send their athletes to Moscow in defiance of government policy. These Games will be remembered for the achievements of Britain's greatest middle-distance runners, Steve Ovett and Sebastian Coe. Sports reporter Derek Mitchell reported these events live for LBC listeners.
The chimes of the Kremlin for 4 o'clock, the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, the 22nd Olympic Games here in Moscow, about to begin, with the President of the Soviet Union, Leonid Brezhnev, arriving in the presidential suite away to my right. To my left, the words Sidious Altius Fortius, faster, higher, stronger, the Olympic motto.
Ovett leads, here comes Coe into third place, he's going to take it off, Ovett is going to win the 800 metres, Ovett wins by 2 metres from Sebastian Coe. The time on the scoreboard, 1:45.4. That's 3 seconds outside the world record. Triumph for Sivo Vett. Disaster for Sebastian Coe.
When you go and you lead, say, from 200 metres, you can't see where everybody else is. You're in front. You can't see anybody chasing you. You can't see how close it is. And when I cross the line, I haven't even seen a replay of the race or anything like that yet. I can't really tell, you know, how easy it was. I mean, I was trying my hardest until I hit the line. So for me, it was a hard race.
You didn't wave your arm and you didn't look round.
No, no.
The first time you've not done either of those.
No, well, in that sort of race with that sort of calibre of athletes, you can't take the chances of waving or looking round. If you're running hard, then you just got to run all the way to the line. That's the way I look at it, and that's exactly what I did.
I don't really remember too much of the race, but I didn't respond when I should have done, and I threw it away over the last lap.
What did you feel about Steve Ovett's tactics?
Well, I mean, what can I say? The guy won. I mean, he was right.
Ovett is not going to make it. Sib Coe is going to win the 1,500 metres. Straub is second. Ovett is third. So it's gold for Sebastian Coe. It's the race he should not have won. It's the race that Ovett should have won. Sebastian Coe breaks down on his knees onto the track. It's gold for Sebastian Coe. He shakes Ovett by the hand. And now Seb Coe waves to the crowd and goes on a lap of honour. A magnificent moment for Sebastian Coe. Steve Ovett is left on his own.
I'd worked very hard this year on that element, which was just changing pace off race pace plus. And I felt quite confident. And looking at the video the other night of the 800 metres, the only thing really to come out of, you know, a minute and three quarters of total disaster was that in the final analysis there was nothing wrong with my finishing. It only did 9/10 of the job.
Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was beginning to develop a new political philosophy which was to dominate the country for the next 10 years. She gave her name to Thatcherism, and LBC's political editor Peter Allen sought to find a definition.
It's like a nurse looking after an ill patient. Which is the better nurse? The one who smothers the patient with sympathies. Never mind, dear, there, you just lie back, I'll bring you all your meals, I'll bring you papers, there, you just lie back, I'll look after you. Or the nurse who says, now come on, I'll just shake out of it. I know you had an operation yesterday, it's time you put your feet to the ground and took a few steps. That's right, dear, that's right. Now get back and take a few more tomorrow. Which do you think is the better nurse?
Well, I know which sounds more like you, Mrs. Thatcher.
Which do you think is likely to achieve results for the patient? The one who says, come on, you can do it. That's me.
1981 will be remembered for the trial of a lorry driver from Bradford called Peter Sutcliffe. He was convicted of murdering 13 women in the north of England, and an Old Bailey judge recommended he serve at least 30 years. His killings destroyed families and created a climate of fear for women. He became known as the Yorkshire Ripper. John Greenwood reported on the biggest murder hunt in Britain since the war.
This man is now detained here in West Yorkshire. I cannot say where he is at the moment, but I can tell you that we are absolutely delighted with developments at this stage. Absolutely delighted.
Keep smiling. Can you all smile?
As he was brought to the magistrate's court, a large crowd gathered outside the building, howling for his blood. Such was the terror Sutcliffe had instilled in people's hearts. He was later sentenced at the Old Bailey to 20 concurrent terms of life imprisonment for the murders of 13 women, with the recommendation that he serve at least 30 years. His conviction came on the day his last victim, student Jacqueline Hill, should have celebrated her 21st birthday. Her mother, Mrs. Doreen Hill, summed up the feeling of many people.
To me, he is an animal, not a human being, and I think he should be treated like an animal. I would like to see him in a room that has absolutely nothing in it. No mattress, blanket, chair, table, newspaper, book. I'd even like his food dropped on the floor so he eats like an animal that he is. I don't believe in God anymore. If there is a God, he's a cruel God, and I want nothing to do with him.
1981 was the year that Ian Botham's name was indelibly engraved in cricket history. With England one down in the Ashes series, he made a pair, that's a duck in both innings, and resigned the captaincy at Lord's. Under Mike Brearley, he made an unbeaten 149 at Headingley to set up the most improbable victory in Test cricket history. Botham then took 5 wickets for 11 runs at Edgbaston, and England were 2-1 up. Many say his 118 at Old Trafford was his greatest contribution of all, and it ensured that England had retained the Ashes.
The main thing for me was when we actually won the Ashes, because that's what it's all about. And after looking like we were going to lose it at one stage, to turn around and win it as we did, it was like give him the crown jewels. You know, it reassured our faith in ourselves as cricketers.
1981 also saw the release of 52 American hostages who'd been held by Iranian revolutionaries for 444 days. They were set free as Ronald Reagan became America's 40th president. Andrew Simmons broadcast their arrival in Wiesbaden, Germany, live on LBC, and this is how London's listeners heard the hostages expressing their first words of freedom.
Some 30 minutes ago, the planes bearing our prisoners left Iranian airspace and are now free of Iran.
A plane has just landed. It is definitely the Flying Nightingale number one flying hospital. And yes, the second plane is just touching down. Americans crowd around, a massive bank of cameras and floodlights. It's taxiing now, it's steering round, thousand stripes, small, large, medium, huge, are waving. And there you can hear the shrill of the jet as it taxis towards me. And even the pilot is waving. What an amazing sight.
What's it been like being a prisoner?
Yeah.
It's been hell.
Did you fear for your lives at all?
I would like to say a thing. There's one more lady that we got to think about, and that's Cynthia Dyer. And I hope nobody ever forgets about her, because we sure as hell won't.
There are 4 Britons still in there as well.
Yes, that's right, and we know that. Oh, it's just a soup. This is just absolutely super.
We're so, you know, there's not words in the American language to say how happy we are and how thankful we are.
Hi.
Thank you, America.
It was a fairy tale wedding, a glorious pageant to bring a sparkle into our lives and distract us from recession. Lady Diana Spencer and the Prince of Wales were to be married in St. Paul's Cathedral. These early interviews and the colour and thrill of the live commentary are perhaps a little poignant now given the present state of the royal marriage. But it was a marvellous historical event, watched by the world and broadcast live by LBC.
We met in November 1977, which Charles came as a friend of my sister, Sarah, for a shoot. I never saw Prince Charles till 77. I was always paired off with Prince Andrew.
When then did you decide to get engaged? Was there a particular time?
Well, it was about 3 weeks ago, believe it or not, just before Dana went to Australia. And she planned to go to Australia quite a long time before anyway, with her mother. And I thought, well, I'll ask her then, so that she can have a chance of thinking it over when she's away and saying, I can't bear the whole idea, or not, as the case may be. But in fact, you accepted, didn't you?
Well, I stood away.
I remember thinking what a very jolly and amusing and attractive 16-year-old she was. And, I mean, great fun, and bouncy and full of life and everything. And I don't know what you thought of me. But...
pretty amazing.
Did it cross either of your minds that in 3 years' time you would be announcing your engagement, thinking of getting married?
No. Not at all.
Did you find it a very hard decision, Lady Diana?
I had a long time to think about it, because I knew the pressure was on, both of us. And it wasn't a difficult decision in the end.
The bride is just about to make her appearance.
Lady Di is coming.
Yes.
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 I think all the crowd's all getting excited. So am I.
There she is. Yes, the bride. Lady Diana Spencer. There she is. And I'm just trying to take a peek at the dress inside the glass coach. And I can't see very much of it, not at this point, but what I can see is that it looks of an ivory sort of colour, and I did notice some hand embroidery there, and the bodice seemed to be fitted and boned with a wide frill around the neckline, and the veil was also ivory in colour and spangled with tiny sparkling things that looked like they might have been pearl sequins or mother of pearl sequins.
And Prince Charles now at the top steps of St. Paul's. A tremendous cheer now for Prince Charles as he enters St. Paul's Cathedral.
The bride has passed us by and should be very shortly in the sight of Peter Dealey outside St. Paul's. But behind the glass coach, the Crown Equerry, Lieutenant Colonel Sir John Mansell Miller, travelling in a Rolls Royce. His job, believe it or not, is to cope with any last-minute emergency, such as a wheel dropping off a coach or a trooper losing his helmet. As far as I know, only one official car broke down. I don't think that any such eventuality has eventuated, but I think now that the bride should be outside St. Paul's and well in the sight of Peter Dealey overlooking the cathedral.
And now Lady Diana about to emerge, and this is the cheer for her. This is the cheer from the crowd of people who want to see her. Sandra Rhodes, you now have a full look at the dress. It's a 27-foot train, I think.
Oh, it's looking absolutely glorious. She's knee-deep in wonderful glittery tulle veil and a crispy taffeta dress. And there's lace on the bodice and lovely cuffs, so her hands look wonderful with the lace sticking out, and then another little frill from the taffeta sleeves with a little bow on it.
I, Charles Philip Arthur George.
I, Charles Philip Arthur George.
Take thee, Diana Francis.
Take thee, Diana Francis.
To my wedded wife.
To my wedded wife.
To have and to hold from this day forward.
To have and to hold from this day forward.
For better, for worse.
For better, for worse.
For richer, for poorer.
For richer, for poorer.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
To love and to cherish.
To love and to cherish.
Till death us do part.
Till death us do part.
According to God's holy law.
According to God's holy law.
And thereto I give thee my troth.
And thereto I give thee my troth.
I, Diana Francis.
I, Diana Francis.
Take thee, Charles Philip Arthur George.
Take thee, Philip Charles Arthur George.
To my wedded husband.
To my wedded husband.
To have and to hold.
To have and to hold.
From this day forward.
From this day forward.
For better, for worse.
For better, for worse.
For richer, for poorer.
For richer, for poorer.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
To love and to cherish.
To love and to cherish.
Till death us do part.
Till death us do part.
According to God's holy law.
According to God's holy law.
And thereto I give thee my troth.
And thereto I give thee my troth.
And standing next to the Earl Spencer, the bride has the ring
Bless,
slipped on.
Bless, O Lord, this ring, and grant that he who gives it and she who shall wear it may remain faithful to each other and abide in thy peace and favor and live together in love until their lives end. Through Jesus Christ our Lord.
Amen.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Drunsey, takes the ring, delivers it to the bridegroom, who puts it
with
on the fourth
this
finger
ring,
of the bride.
With this ring,
I thee wed.
I thee wed.
With my body.
With my body.
I thee honor.
I thee honor.
And all my worldly goods with thee I share.
All thy goods with thee I share.
In the name of the Father.
The name of the Father.
And of the Son.
And of the Son.
And of the Holy Ghost.
And of the Holy Ghost.
Amen.
Amen.
Those whom God has joined together, let no man put asunder. For as much as Charles Philip Arthur George and Diana Francis have consented together in holy wedlock, and have witnessed the same before God and this company, and thereto have given and pledged their troth either to other, and have declared the same by giving and receiving of a ring and by joining of hands, I pronounce that they be man and wife together, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost. Amen.
So the crowds who travel from every corner of the land and from all over the world can now see the Prince and Princess of Wales. And the cheers tell their own story as they step down the steps now of St. Paul's towards the 1902 State Lando, which will carry them back to St. Paul's on that long-awaited bike reappearance. And the crowd really now enjoying it, enjoying the spectacle.
In the early 80s, many cities in Britain saw an explosion of public disorder. Riots involving youths resulted in death, injury, looting, and the destruction of property. Some commentators blame the social unrest on poverty, lack of opportunity, discrimination, and aggressive policing policies against Britain's ethnic communities. Police officers found themselves ill-equipped to deal with stones and petrol bombs. Reporter Paul Davis brought you this live report at the height of the Toxteth riots in Liverpool.
And the noise that you can hear now is the police beating on their riot shields as they move into a barrier in the centre of the road. They're coming under fire now. Missiles is a large crowd of youngsters at the other end of the street. They seem to have got hold of a civilian car. They've turned the person out of it and they're pushing it towards the direction now of the police barricade. The police are moving up the street and they're coming under heavy fire. They're now forming something that looks rather like the old Roman system of using their riot shields to protect not only their sides but also their heads. And bottles just coming in. One just landed very near to me and a stone just there. The police are having to duck for cover beneath their riot shields, and the stones really are flying in. Some of the youths, their faces are hidden by scarves and masks. That car that was taken has been crashed into some railings, and the police are now moving in again, beating their riot shields and trying to break up a crowd of youths who are now sprinting back up the streets, still throwing bottles and bricks at the police. The police have moved about 10 yards and are now consolidating their position. They've won the last 10, 15 yards and are now again putting up this barrier of riot shields. Again, the stones and bricks are coming through thick and fast at them. That car is now being moved by the police. They've managed to get on the right side of that car and they're moving it out of the way. The police looking to be getting some form of control of the situation now. There are other cars being stopped by the youths, and they're trying to use them, I think, as weapons against the police barricade. The police have seen this and are now moving forward once again. The scream of tyres there as the police move in and the cars are being pulled out. The police have now reached a very difficult position. It's a crossroads and they're coming under fire from three different directions. They're trying to block all three roads that lead into this crossroads. And they're still facing a large and very angry crowd. It's a mixture of black and white youths. And there goes the first petrol bomb that I've seen. It came flying over the ranks of the policemen, burst into fire. Nobody seems hurt at this moment. Policemen putting it out with a fire extinguisher. But there comes another one, a bottle straight into the ranks of the policemen. The crowd screaming as that Molotov cocktail burst into flames. None of the policemen seemed to be injured, although it landed right in the middle of them. The petrol spilling over the road, the bottles and bricks still raining in, and the police trying to put out the fire now.
Some say it restored Britain's sense of pride in itself. Others say it saved Mrs. Thatcher from political oblivion. For LBC, the Falklands War demonstrated that independent radio could cover a national emergency as well as any news organisation. In 1982, London listeners turned to us for the latest developments. We had reporters at the Ministry of Defence, at the United Nations, the only British woman radio journalist in Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires, Antonia Higgs, and we sent a young radio reporter, Kim Sabido, with the task force. His journalism was in the best tradition of war reporting, honest, vivid, sensitive, and informative. It was on April the 2nd, 1982, that we heard this dramatic news.
It's 5 o'clock. This is Bill Bingham. Argentina has invaded the Falkland Islands, and its marines have taken control of the colony, which has been in British hands for almost 150 years. There are no reports of casualties, either among the 1,800 English-speaking islanders or among the small force of marines there to protect them. Our diplomatic correspondent, David Spanier, reports that the takeover is now being admitted unofficially by the British government.
Officials in Whitehall fear that the British administration in Port Stanley has been overrun by the invasion forces. The Foreign Office has still not given official confirmation of the invasion because of the difficulty in establishing radio links with the British governor. The explanation is that the Argentine forces have interrupted communications between Port Stanley and London, and no contact has been possible since this morning. Lord Carrington is holding crisis talks at the Foreign Office to decide on the British course of action, and an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council will be held shortly to consider the international repercussions of the crisis.
According to Argentine news agencies, a battalion of Marines landed near the Falklands capital, Port Stanley, this morning. They took over the British barracks, the airport, and the capital, Port Stanley, apparently without meeting serious resistance. The British governor of the islands, Rex Hunt, is now reported to have gone on local radio appealing for calm and urging islanders not to provoke the invaders. An Argentine statement says they'll respect the lives and property of the islanders, but anyone offering resistance will be punished according to the law. The British government is reported to have sent more warships to the region, though this hasn't been confirmed. However, Industry Minister Patrick Jenkins said earlier that ships are at sea.
Right, well, I have now His Excellency the Governor on the phone again. Could you give us the latest situation, please, sir?
Yes, it's quiet at the moment, but we're pinned down. We've been trying to move up the people a bit further out from the perimeter of Government House, and every time anybody tries to move, they start shooting. So they've got us well and truly pinned down. But they're not trying to attack, so I think they're waiting for the armoured personnel vehicles to come. And then I think maybe they'll have another go.
Yeah, how long, much longer do you think you can hold out, sir?
Well, I mean, if they've got 30mm cannon on these armoured personnel carriers, so one or two shots of them and we'd be finished, I'm afraid.
Yes, sir.
But I'm hopeful that they'll send somebody in to talk.
And you'll talk to them, will you, sir?
I'll talk to them, but I'm not walking out. I'm not surrendering to the bloody arches, Patrick, certainly not.
HMS Sheffield, a Type 42 destroyer, was attacked and hit late this afternoon by an Argentine missile. The ship caught fire, which spread out of control. When there was no longer any hope of saving the ship's company abandoned ship. All who abandoned her were picked up. It is feared that there have been a number of casualties, but we have no details of them yet.
The objective, capture and securing of the high ground towards Stanley, almost the last strategic high ground between us and Port Stanley. After three postponements due to bad weather and other unforeseen problems, the whole British front line moved forward from the north and against the central mountain pillars to the west of the capital. We set off sometime before midnight GMT, a clear and bitterly cold night. It was sometime before the moon was up, and yet the rifle company I decided to accompany moved swiftly towards its starting point. Heavily camouflaged, brown cream spread across our faces, the final minutes before the attack were tense ones for everybody, especially our unit commander. Having endured 2 weeks of cold and wet in the mountains, being able to see Stanley and its defences, but never being able to do much more than harass them, this, for he and his men, was the moment.
It's actually a month since we've been here, and it's 2 weeks since we've been on top of the mountains we've just come off. So we're all actually extremely glad to get moving and get off them, because it's like a kind of nightmarish Dartmoor, as you've seen, particularly when the weather's bad. The other thing is that we've been waiting long enough now, and we need to get on and get it over with. We first of all want to get it over because we want to get home, but secondly, we're a diminishing asset. I've had about 25 chaps who've had to be cut about because their feet have gone in the cold and the wet. And that's a trickle that could become a serious problem if we stay here very much longer.
Do you believe the Argentines now surrounding Stanley will put up a stiff fight?
It's difficult to tell. I think probably what will happen is that they'll fight initially, and I think when they discover, first of all, the determination that is going to be brought to bear against them, and secondly, the odds that we've got, because we've managed to concentrate a fairly formidable force now, hopefully that'll crack, and rather likely did a goose green, they'll surrender fairly quickly. That's what I hope will happen.
More tracer shells, more gunfire, keeping the troops pinned down. At the moment, sheltering behind a rock, some 200 or 300 meters from where the gunfire is coming from. For more than 2 hours now, the troops around us have been kept pinned down whilst they try and winkle out the resistance on the ridge above us. One machine gun post has already been taken out by a Milan anti-tank missile, but there seems to be more resistance still up there. Every time a head is poked out or we make a move across the side of the slope, they open up. The whole thing at the moment lit by only the moon. Again, more gunfire. Flashes of red light. And every now and then, of course, tracer the red embers which flash across the sky, bouncing off rocks, and on several occasions missing. Missing us by feet.
Level.
Yes. Shell. That one just whizzed straight over my head and landed about 50 feet further down the slope. There's a machine gun fire from our own side. Tracer shells racing out from behind the slope, behind the rocks at the top of the ridge. You can now smell the cordite in the air after more than 2 hours of fighting. They've been waiting for this moment for almost 2 weeks. 2 weeks of relative misery under makeshift bivouacs in some of the worst conditions the Falklands in winter have to offer. Snow, rain, and always the biting winds. There'd been the crushing disappointment of 3 postponements, 2 raising hopes that made the subsequent waiting just that bit more unbearable. But then, on Friday night, it happened. The heavy guns were ready, several hundred rounds apiece, each man fully laden, too. The men moved forward slowly to their start line, dropping off their backpacks at a central place, so that, for the hours of heavy fighting ahead, they could move quickly and quietly. For the men I was with, this was their first real test since D-Day 3 weeks before. For me, it was to be the first face-to-face confrontation with the cold, harsh realities of war. I had a choice. The unit's colonel advised staying back with his own tactical headquarters. For some reason, which I cannot explain, I decided to go with the fighting company I'd spent the previous week with on the mountain. After 15 hours of marching and fighting, I was to realize, like some naive new recruit, just why I'd been given that advice. I've now tasted war at its most naked and found it a deeply moving yet ultimately depressing experience. Seeing men shot by machine gun and blasted by artillery shells and coming within inches of suffering a similar fate, I can honestly say my thirst for action, if that was what it was, has been fully satisfied. I pray earnestly I shall never have to face a night like that again. And I can assure you there are many more young men here who share that sentiment. The walk in complete silence from our start point took an age, stopping and starting several times, sometimes for suspected minefields, other times as we passed through friendly patrols. It left us behind schedule and all the more unprepared for what happened next. Heavily camouflaged with brown cream smeared across our faces, we waited near a track. Our objective to the north dominated the skyline. Suddenly, flashes out to sea indicated the start of a naval bombardment. It continued for several hours as advanced units called down fire from our own guns onto difficult positions. Watching the shells explode was like witnessing some terrible midnight firework display as the ground held by the Argentines along the upper slopes erupted in convulsions of yellow and black, throwing earth and sometimes bodies feet into the air.
You can hear the bullets now whizzing around us, ricocheting off the rocks. A heavy salvo of small arms fire, machine gun fire coming both down the hill and then up the hill in reply from the British troops ahead of me. More incoming gunfire from Argentine batteries around Stanley, keeping everybody's heads down. Somebody's been hit up a front. Good. Everything now landing far too close for comfort. I just heard somebody up front about 20 or 30 feet has received a bullet in the leg or something.
Thousands of soldiers, hardened regulars, along with more bewildered conscripts, poured back into the capital yesterday in front of the British advance, their white flags flying from every window and every chimney. Under the terms of the ceasefire, they've been ordered to throw down their arms and gather in central places around the town, ready for shipment back to Argentina. Over the last few days, they've made a sorry sight, beaten, confused young men, most of whom with not even a lost cause to cling to. Now they look even more pathetic, huddled in groups, some supporting their wounded colleagues by a shoulder or arm, others just lounging in khaki winter gear, unshaven and dispirited. The British paras are unshaven too, but they are far from dispirited. The 2nd Battalion led the entry into Stanley, which finally cracks the Argentine defence. They and the Marines know the battle is over. Their duties now are to search and number the prisoners and dream of the journey home. But the sweetest taste in a sad affair is for Major Mike Norman of 4-2 Commando, the Royal Marines. It was he and his men who were unceremoniously kicked out of Stanley 10 weeks ago by the Argentine invaders after a bitter 3-hour battle. Today, just as he said he would, he plans to raise the Union Jack on the flagpole at the old British base at Moody Brook, 3 miles out of town. The camp has been shattered by war, but for Major Mike and his men, this one ironic gesture says more than 1,000 words about the futility of the Argentine invasion and the courage of the men who've helped to repel it. Kim Sabido, IRN, on the Falklands.
May I give the House the latest information about the Battle of the Falklands? After successful attacks last night, General Moore decided to press forward. The Argentinians retreated. Our forces reached the outskirts of Port Stanley. Large numbers of Argentine soldiers threw down their weapons. They are reported to be flying white flags over Port Stanley. Our troops have been ordered not to fire except in self-defense. Talks are now in progress between General Menendez and our deputy commander, Brigadier Waters, about the surrender of the Argentine forces on East and West Falkland. Yeah.
This council salutes all those thousands of men and women who took part in the planning and execution of what will surely go down in history as one of the most successful military operations of all time. If I may paraphrase Churchill's immortal words, never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so few to so many.
Wonderful news, and it's Great Britain. Marvellous forces, every single one of them. It's just been everyone together, and that's what matters. We knew what we had to do. We knew what we had to do. And we went about it and did it.
Do you think the ceasefire will help?
I believe so. There's still one or two things. Just listen to everyone. I must go down and wave them.
Excellent. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
I never had any doubts at all that what we were
all
doing
the way
was right.
Yeah.
All right.
All the way through.
I never had any doubts
well,
that we had
great.
To do it. I never had any doubts in our armed forces. I knew it would be difficult, but I knew that they would do it.
Yeah. Prime Minister, do you think it's going to be a surrender?
Yes, I believe so.
Looking back on 3 months spent covering my own country's war from supposed enemy territory, the whole experience seems quite bizarre. Not least because President Galtieri, in his wisdom, actually allowed us to stay for the whole duration of the fighting. When I left London, Falklands fever was just beginning to build up. What a contrast with the Malvinas madness that had already gripped Buenos Aires.
I'm Argentine. To Malvinas is Argentine. Only Argentine. Mrs. Thatcher. I don't speak about Mrs. Thatcher.
In Malvinas, the land is Argentine.
Away from the demonstrations, the riots and the hysteria, the Argentine people treated the British press with quite amazing consideration and understanding. There were threats and ugly incidents, but only one small section of the society was involved. The surrender at Stanley and the end of the war was an uneasy time for everyone. A people who'd been so badly let down by a government who'd assured them that they could hold on to the islands were in no mood to answer the queries of journalists. They took to the streets to protest, and though most of the anger was vented against the military, there were warnings that Britain would do well to remember now.
Maybe Puerto Argentino is going to surrender, but the war is not going to stop. The war is still on.
No, they shall not grow old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.
We will remember them.
There was another war in 1982. The civil war in the Lebanon continued and became even more complicated when the Israelis decided to launch a full-blown invasion to drive the Palestinians from the country. The Israeli Prime Minister of the time was Menachem Begin, who had achieved the peace treaty with Egypt's Anwar Sadat. Yasser Arafat led the beleaguered and divided Palestinians. Radio journalists Andrew Simmons and Phil Longman sent these reports from Beirut.
A bombardment of shells from warships to the west and Israeli artillery in the hills of the east blitzed West Beirut. When the sun did rise, it couldn't penetrate through a fog of black and grey dust and smoke.
Nobody is going to bring Israel to her knees. You must have forgotten. The Jews do not kneel but to God.
79 days facing the hell with these people, with the children, with the women, and no power moved to stop them, except our flesh, our blood. It's shameful.
The sound you can hear isn't a gun battle, but the Palestinian guerrillas celebrating the evacuation of some of the first wave of guerrillas down in the port area of Beirut.
The ravages and meaninglessness of war leave lasting impressions on the journalists who risk their lives to bring us the stories. Andrew Simmons booked into an hotel on his arrival in Beirut and went out with some colleagues. On his return, he found his hotel had been reduced to a pile of rubble. He witnessed human suffering on a vast scale, and he later described how one experience left a lasting impression.
You could hear the screaming of a mother who believes her child is underneath a huge piece of concrete. I can't really describe in any acceptable tone what I can see now. There is the body of a man underneath a massive slab of concrete. Only a leg showing. There could be no hope for rescuing this man. But the mother insists she heard the screams of her child underneath all of this. And so the bulldozer moves forward and relief workers crowd around what really can't be anything else but a massive, hideous concrete graveyard.
What you can hear now is that woman about 20 minutes afterwards running in blind panic through the streets, not having found her child. That's a story, just one story of the tragic circumstances involved. And just the blind terror, and also the aspect of no organisation being involved in this relief operation. That was the frightening part of it. These people weren't trained in it. This is the noise of an ambulance, for instance, which is trying to get through. After I'd done that commentary, it couldn't get through because the bulldozer was just driving backwards and forwards wildly. And somebody was dying underneath. There was another woman crying because she didn't want the bulldozer to bash into the body that was there. It's just that will always live in my mind. And in fact, in terms of lasting impressions, that is what it is.
In 1983, Mrs. Thatcher won her second general election. It was a landslide against Labour, led by Michael Foot, and another opportunity to write a further chapter of the book called Thatcherism. She saw herself as leading her country on a return back to Victorian values.
Well, there's no great mystery about those. I was brought up by a Victorian grandmother. We were taught to work jolly hard. You were taught to improve yourself. You were taught self-reliance. You were taught to live within your income. You were taught that cleanliness was next to godliness. You were taught self-respect. You were taught always to give a hand to your neighbour. You were taught tremendous pride in your country. You were taught to be a good member of your community. All of these things are Victorian values.
In the United States, President Reagan was developing a more interventionist foreign policy. It led to a disaster in Beirut when hundreds of Marines died in suicide car bomb attacks. The Americans believed Cuba had taken over the little Caribbean island of Grenada. LBC reporter Antonia Higgs covered the invasion by U.S. forces of a member of the Commonwealth.
Revolutionary Military Council is calling on all friendly, peace-loving countries to condemn this act of aggression and immediately come to Grenada's aid, because at 5:40 this morning, foreign troops began landing in Grenada. The people's armed forces are engaging them in battle, and we call...
Citizens of Grenada, military forces from neighboring Caribbean nations and the United States have arrived in Grenada to protect lives and restore order. Your cooperation will ensure that peace and democracy are restored in the near future.
An American helicopter leaves its base near the new airport, transporting Marines to other trouble areas. In one dramatic encounter, six soldiers armed with submachine guns hauled two men out of a vehicle, pushed them up against a wall, their arms outstretched.
Documents that captured in the back of the car seem to indicate that one is an intelligence officer in a PRA and the other appears to be possibly a company commander in a PRA.
I appreciate if you wouldn't talk to them right now until they've been processed by our battalion. That's on Degenhardt. Take them down.
Let's go! Up! Down lane, I want you to lead it out.
Back it up, gentlemen. Let's go!
Go! Back off.
Here, go back. We're a nation with global responsibilities. We're not somewhere else in the world protecting someone else's interests. We're there protecting our own. We have discovered a complete base with weapons and communications equipment which makes it clear a Cuban occupation of the island had been planned.
A Scottish widow woke up one morning in 1983 to discover that her son had been arrested for being one of Britain's most notorious mass murderers. Dennis Nielsen was convicted of murdering 15 young men. The former probationer policeman had dismembered their bodies, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment at the Old Bailey, with a recommendation he served at least 25 years. His mother, Betty, greeted journalists with dignity and openness when they knocked on her door in a remote village in the northeast of Scotland.
It was just a different life he had in London, and as I thought, he always talked as if he was happy there. He loved his job and his little dog, and I just thought he was happy. Because none of us can say anything wrong about Dennis apart from this, because he never did anything wrong we know of. I'm just hoping it's a dream and I'll wake up. I can't see him doing this, the boy I knew. And I just don't understand it. No, I have no reason at all. I don't know what's changed him or what's made him do this. It's just something I expect I'll never understand. Oh, I just can't imagine it. I just can't imagine he's done that. I don't know how I'll feel. I'll feel terrible. Because after all, well, all these people are killed. And these boys have mothers the same as I am. I just feel terrible.
The 1980s saw a dwindling of union power through anti-picketing laws. Restrictive practices in the newspaper industry were also challenged. Fleet Street was eventually dispersed. The entrepreneur who pioneered the introduction of new technology was Eddie Shah. But in 1983, the Print Union, the National Graphical Association, tried to stop the operation of his plant in Warrington. Reporter Chris Mann was there.
The first ugly scenes came when a dozen policemen were crushed up against the wall of the factory as the pickets charged their lines. Scuffles broke out and punches were thrown as police reinforcements arrived and demonstrators were dragged away. Then the police went on the offensive, linking arms to form human chains four or five deep. The pickets responded with a hail of missiles, stones, bottles, cans, and even full thermos flasks. There were some horrific injuries, head and face gashes. One officer was hit in the eye, another suffered a fractured skull. Then, in a military-style operation, 500 officers wearing visored riot helmets charged the crowd, with special snatch squads dragging pickets away. And then, exactly on the stroke of 5 o'clock, the doors of the factory rolled open and the first truck roared away to jeers and catcalls from the defeated pickets.
It's terrible that in this country we come to a situation when sort of vigilante mafia bully boy tactics that are going on outside. I mean, that's Nazism, that's breaking windows of Jewish storekeepers. That's that sort of stuff going on outside that door. And what you're saying to me is, can you carry on in business when the Nazis are outside smashing my windows? The answer's got to be yes, otherwise we don't have a democracy to live in.
In 1983, the IRA continued its bloody campaign of terrorism both in Northern Ireland and on the streets of London. A car bomb outside Harrods killed two police officers and four Christmas shoppers. 91 people were injured.
The gases, you know, go everywhere and the smoke and all the people just scared. I seen the blood, then I seen everything.
There were two explosions, then we just saw flying glass. I rushed upstairs and the receptionist, who was sitting 50 yards from it, a bit shaken. There were people running around covered in blood and glass, and police were there in a shot, though. Amazing.
He had a hole in his head and in his hands, and a lady and I, we helped him because he was in the toilets, and he had all his hair was just frizzled all up, and there's glass everywhere and blood was just pouring out, and he was going to faint, so we sat him down, and a lady helped me get him outside, and then we just waited till the ambulance came.
It would seem that there have been some children who have been hurt. Anything is bad news. Perhaps that is the worst of all. I don't think there's anything else that I can add. I think this is even worse than everything one knew previously. It is really wicked. And I said earlier, it's a crime against humanity. It's a crime against Christmas too.
In 1984, the IRA nearly succeeded in wiping out the entire British cabinet. A time delay bomb left in the Grand Hotel in Brighton detonated in the middle of the Conservative Party conference. Five people died. Norman Tebbit's wife was paralysed. Mrs. Thatcher escaped and was lucky to be alive.
Very well, thank you very much. Our worry is whether there's anyone under that rubble, because I don't know whether you've seen it, but it's pretty awful. We were all very, very fortunate. Very fortunate indeed.
Were you asleep at the time, Prime Minister?
I'm not quite sure the chance of the exchange. No, I was up working. The bomb went off somewhere between 2:45 and 3:00. I know that because I looked up when I'd finished something at 2:45.
The wall just collapsed. All this dust, glass and everything went everywhere. Well, some of those people, that woman in there has come down 5 floors. She was on the 5th floor and she finished up in the basement.